Will you please be quiet, please? This book is for Marianne. Fat. I am sitting over coffee and cigarettes at my friend Rita's, and I am telling her about it. Here is what I tell her. It is late of a slow Wednesday when Herb seats the fat man at my station. This fat man is the fattest person I have ever seen, though he is neat-appearing and well-dressed enough. Everything about him is big, but it is the fingers I remember best. When I stop at the table near his to see to the old couple, I first notice the fingers. They look 3 times the size of a normal person's fingers. Long, thick, creamy fingers. I see to my other tables, a party of 4 businessmen, very demanding, another party of 4, 3 men and a woman, and this old couple. Leander has poured the fat man's water, and I give the fat man plenty of time to make up his mind before going over. Good evening, I say. May I serve you? I say. Rita, he was big. I mean big. Good evening, he says. Hello, yes, he says. I think we're ready to order now, he says. He has this way of speaking. Strange, don't you know? And he makes a little puffing sound every so often.
I think we will begin with a Caesar salad, he says.
And then a bowl of soup with some extra bread and butter, if you please. The lamb chops, I believe, he says. And baked potato with sour cream. We'll see about dessert later. Thank you very much, he says, and hands me the menu. God, Rita, but those were fingers. I hurry away to the kitchen and turn in the order to Rudy, who takes it with a face. You know Rudy. Rudy is that way when he works. As I come out of the kitchen, Margot, I've told you about Margot, the one who chases Rudy. Margot says to me, who's your fat friend? He's really a fatty. Now that's part of it. I think that is really part of it. I make the Caesar salad there at his table, him watching my every move, meanwhile buttering pieces of bread and laying them off to one side, all the time making this puffing noise. Anyway, I am so keyed up or something. I knock over his glass of water. I'm so sorry, I say. It always happens when you get into a hurry. I'm very sorry, I say. Are you all right? I say. I'll get the boy to clean up right away, I say. It's nothing, he says. It's all right, he says, and he puffs. Don't worry about it. We don't mind, he says. He smiles and waves as I go off to get Leander, and when I come back to serve the salad, I see the fat man has eaten all his bread and butter. A little later, when I bring him more bread, he has finished his salad. You know the size of those Caesar salads?
You're very kind, he says. This bread is marvelous, he says.
Thank you, I say.
Well, it is very good, he says, and we mean that. We don't often enjoy bread like this, he says.
Where are you from? I ask him. I don't believe I've seen you before, I say.
He's not the kind of person you'd forget, Rita puts in with a snicker. Denver, he says.
I don't say anything more on the subject, though I am curious. Your soup will be along in a few minutes, sir, I say, and I go off to put the finishing touches to my party of 4 businessmen, very demanding. When I serve his soup, I see the bread has disappeared again. He is just putting the last piece of bread into his mouth.
Believe me, he says, we don't eat like this all the time, he says, and puffs. You'll have to excuse us, he says.
Don't think a thing about it, please, I say. I like to see a man eat and enjoy himself, I say.
I don't know, he says. I guess that's what you'd call it.
And puffs. He arranges the napkin. Then he picks up his spoon.
God, he's fat, says Leander.
He can't help it, I say, so shut up. I put down another basket of bread and more butter. How was the soup? I say.
Thank you, good, he says. Very good, he says.
He wipes his lips and dabs his chin.
Do you think it's warm in here, or is it just me? He says. No, it is warm in here, I say. Maybe we'll take off our coat, he says. Go right ahead, I say. A person has to be comfortable, I say. That's true, he says. That is very, very true, he says. But I see a little later that he is still wearing his coat. My large parties are gone now, and also the old couple. The place is emptying out. By the time I serve the fat man his chops and baked potato, along with more bread and butter, he is the only one left. I drop lots of sour cream onto his potato. I sprinkle bacon and chives over his sour cream. I bring him more bread and butter. Is everything all right? I say. Fine, he says, and he puffs. Excellent, thank you, he says, and puffs again. Enjoy your dinner, I say. I raise the lid of his sugar bowl and look in. He nods and keeps looking at me until I move away. I know now I was after something, but I don't know what. How is old Tub of Guts doing? He's going to run your legs off, says Harriet. You know Harriet. For dessert, I say to the fat man, there is the Green Lantern Special, which is a pudding cake with sauce, or there is cheesecake, or vanilla ice cream, or pineapple sherbet. We're not making you late, are we? He says, puffing and looking concerned. Not at all, I say. Of course not, I say. Take your time, I say. I'll bring you more coffee while you make up your mind. We'll be honest with you, he says, and he moves in the seat. We would like the special, but we may have a dish of vanilla ice cream as well, with just a drop of chocolate syrup, if you please. We told you we were hungry, he says. I go off to the kitchen to see after his dessert myself, and Rudy says, Harriet says you got a fat man from the circus out there. That true? Rudy has his apron and hat off now, if you see what I mean. Rudy, he is fat, I say, but that is not the whole story. Rudy just laughs. Sounds to me like she's sweet on fat stuff, he says. Better watch out, Rudy, says Joanne, who just that minute comes into the kitchen. I'm getting jealous, Rudy says to Joanne. I put the special in front of the fat man and a big bowl of vanilla ice cream with chocolate syrup to the side. Thank you, he says. You are very welcome, I say, and a feeling comes over me. Believe it or not, he says, we have not always eaten like this. Me, I eat and I eat and I can't gain, I say. I'd like to gain, I say. No, he says. If we had our choice, no, but there is no choice. Then he picks up his spoon and eats. What else? Rita says, lighting one of my cigarettes and pulling her chair closer to the table. This story's getting interesting now, Rita says. That's it. Nothing else. He eats his desserts, and then he leaves, and then we go home, Rudy and me. Some fatty, Rudy says, stretching like he does when he's tired. Then he just laughs and goes back to watching the TV. I put the water on to boil for tea and take a shower. I put my hand on my middle and wonder what would happen if I had children, and one of them turned out to look like that, so fat. I pour the water in the pot, arrange the cups, the sugar bowl, carton of half and half, and take the tray into Rudy. As if he's been thinking about it, Rudy says, I knew a fat guy once, a couple of fat guys, really fat guys, when I was a kid. They were tubbies, my God. I don't remember their names. Fat. That's the only name this one kid had. We called him Fat, the kid who lived next door to me. He was a neighbor. The other kid came along later. His name was Wobbly. Everybody called him Wobbly except the teachers. Wobbly and Fat. Wish I had their pictures, Rudy says. I can't think of anything to say, so we drink our tea, and pretty soon I get up to go to bed. Rudy gets up too, turns off the TV, locks the front door, and begins his unbuttoning. I get into bed and move clear over to the edge and lie there on my stomach. But right away, as soon as he turns off the light and gets into bed, Rudy begins. I turn on my back and relax some, though it is against my will. But here's the thing. When he gets on me, I suddenly feel I am fat. I feel I am terrifically fat, so fat that Rudy is a tiny thing and hardly there at all.
That's a funny story, Rita says. But I can see she doesn't know what to make of it.
I feel depressed. But I won't go into it with her. I've already told her too much. She sits there waiting, her dainty fingers poking her hair.
Waiting for what? I'd like to know.
It is August. My life is going to change. I feel it.
Neighbors. Bill and Arlene Miller were a happy couple. But now and then they felt they alone among their circle had been passed by somehow, leaving Bill to attend to his bookkeeping duties and Arlene occupied with secretarial chores. They talked about it sometimes, mostly in comparison with the lives of their neighbors, Harriet and Jim Stone. It seemed to the Millers that the Stones lived a fuller and brighter life. The Stones were always going out for dinner or entertaining at home or traveling about the country somewhere in connection with Jim's work. The Stones lived across the hall from the Millers. Jim was a salesman for a machine parts firm and often managed to combine business with pleasure trips, and on this occasion the Stones would be away for 10 days, first to Cheyenne, then on to St. Louis to visit relatives. In their absence, the Millers would look after the Stones' apartment, feed Kitty, and water the plants. Bill and Jim shook hands beside the car. Harriet and Arlene held each other by the elbows and kissed lightly on the lips.
"Have fun," Bill said to Harriet.
"We will," said Harriet. "You kids have fun, too."
Arlene nodded. Jim winked at her.
"Bye, Arlene. Take good care of the old man."
"I will," Arlene said.
"Have fun," Bill said.
"You bet," Jim said, clipping Bill lightly on the arm.
"And thanks again, you guys."
The Stones waved as they drove away, and the Millers waved too.
"Well, I wish it was us," Bill said.
"God knows we could use a vacation," Arlene said. She took his arm and put it around her waist as they climbed the stairs to their apartment. After dinner, Arlene said, "Don't forget, Kitty gets liver flavor the first night." She stood in the kitchen doorway folding the handmade tablecloth that Harriet had bought for her last year in Santa Fe. Bill took a deep breath as he entered the Stones' apartment. The air was already heavy, and it was vaguely sweet. The sunburst clock over the television said 8:30. He remembered when Harriet had come home with the clock, how she had crossed the hall to show it to Arlene, cradling the brass case in her arms and talking to it through the tissue paper as if it were an infant. Kitty rubbed her face against his slippers and then turned onto her side, but jumped up quickly as Bill moved to the kitchen and selected one of the stacked cans from the gleaming drain board. Leaving the cat to pick at her food, he headed for the bathroom. He looked at himself in the mirror, and then closed his eyes, and then looked again. He opened the medicine chest. He found a container of pills and read the label, "Harriet Stone, one each day as directed," and slipped it into his pocket. He went back to the kitchen, drew a pitcher of water, and returned to the living room. He finished watering, set the pitcher on the rug, and opened the liquor cabinet. He reached in back for the bottle of Chivas Regal. He took 2 drinks from the bottle, wiped his lips on his sleeve, and replaced the bottle in the cabinet. Kitty was on the couch sleeping. He switched off the lights, slowly closing and checking the door. He had the feeling he had left something.
"What kept you?" Arlene said.
She sat with her legs turned under her, watching television.
"Nothing. Playing with Kitty," he said, and went over to her and touched her breasts. "Let's go to bed, honey," he said.
The next day, Bill took only 10 minutes of the 20-minute break allotted for the afternoon and left at 15 minutes before 5.
He parked the car in the lot just as Arlene hopped down from the bus. He waited until she entered the building, then ran up the stairs to catch her as she stepped out of the elevator.
"Bill, God, you scared me. You're early," she said.
He shrugged. "Nothing to do at work," he said. She let him use her key to open the door. He looked at the door across the hall before following her inside. "Let's go to bed," he said.
"Now?"
she laughed.
"What's gotten into you?"
"Nothing. Take your dress off." He grabbed for her awkwardly and she said,
"Good God, Bill."
He unfastened his belt. Later, they sent out for Chinese food, and when it arrived, they ate hungrily, without speaking, and listened to records. "Let's not forget to feed Kitty," she said.
"I was just thinking about that," he said. "I'll go right over."
He selected a can of fish flavor for the cat, then filled the pitcher and went to water. When he returned to the kitchen, the cat was scratching in her box. She looked at him steadily before she turned back to the litter. He opened all the cupboards and examined the canned goods, the cereals, the packaged foods, the cocktail and wine glasses, the china, the pots and pans. He opened the refrigerator. He sniffed some celery, took two bites of cheddar cheese, and chewed on an apple as he walked into the bedroom. The bed seemed enormous, with a fluffy white bedspread draped to the floor. He pulled out a nightstand drawer, found a half-empty package of cigarettes, and stuffed them into his pocket. Then he stepped to the closet and was opening it when the knock sounded at the front door. He stopped by the bathroom and flushed the toilet on his way.
"What's been keeping you?" Arlene said. "You've been over here more than an hour."
"Have I really?" he said.
"Yes, you have," she said.
"I had to go to the toilet," he said.
"You have your own toilet," she said.
"I couldn't wait," he said.
That night, they made love again. In the morning, he had Arlene call in for him. He showered, dressed, and made a light breakfast. He tried to start a book. He went out for a walk and felt better. But after a while, hands still in his pockets, he returned to the apartment. He stopped at the Stones' door on the chance he might hear the cat moving about. Then he let himself in at his own door and went to the kitchen for the key. Inside, it seemed cooler than his apartment, and darker, too. He wondered if the plants had something to do with the temperature of the air. He looked out the window, and then he moved slowly through each room, considering everything that fell under his gaze, carefully, one object at a time. He saw ashtrays, items of furniture, kitchen utensils, the clock. He saw everything. At last, he entered the bedroom, and the cat appeared at his feet. He stroked her once, carried her into the bathroom, and shut the door. He lay down on the bed and stared at the ceiling. He lay for a while with his eyes closed, and then he moved his hand under his belt. He tried to recall what day it was. He tried to remember when the Stones were due back, and then he wondered if they would ever return. He could not remember their faces or the way they talked and dressed. He sighed and, with effort, rolled off the bed to lean over the dresser and look at himself in the mirror. He opened the closet and selected a Hawaiian shirt. He looked until he found Bermudas, neatly pressed and hanging over a pair of brown twill slacks. He shed his own clothes and slipped into the shorts and the shirt. He looked in the mirror again. He went to the living room and poured himself a drink and sipped it on his way back to the bedroom. He put on a blue shirt, a dark suit, a blue and white tie, black wingtip shoes. The glass was empty and he went for another drink. In the bedroom again, he sat on a chair, crossed his legs and smiled, observing himself in the mirror. The telephone rang twice and fell silent. He finished the drink and took off the suit. He rummaged through the top drawers until he found a pair of panties and a brassiere. He stepped into the panties and fastened the brassiere. Then he looked through the closet for an outfit. He put on a black and white checkered skirt and tried to zip it up. He put on a burgundy blouse that buttoned up the front. He considered her shoes, but understood they would not fit.
For a long time, he looked out the living room window from behind the curtain. Then he returned to the bedroom and put everything away. He was not hungry. She did not eat much either. They looked at each other shyly and smiled. She got up from the table and checked that the key was on the shelf, and then she quickly cleared the dishes. He stood in the kitchen doorway and smoked a cigarette and watched her pick up the key. "Make yourself comfortable while I go across the hall," she said. "Read the paper or something." She closed her fingers over the key. He was, she said, looking tired. He tried to concentrate on the news. He read the paper and turned on the television. Finally, he went across the hall. The door was locked.
"It's me. Are you still there, honey?"
he called. After a time, the lock released and Arlene stepped outside and shut the door. "Was I gone so long?" she said.
"Well, you were," he said.
"Was I?" she said. "I guess I must have been playing with Kitty." He studied her, and she looked away, her hand still resting on the doorknob. "It's funny," she said. "You know, to go in someone's place like that." He nodded, took her hand from the knob, and guided her toward their own door. He let them into their apartment.
"It is funny," he said.
He noticed white lint clinging to the back of her sweater, and the color was high in her cheeks. He began kissing her on the neck and hair, and she turned and kissed him back.
"Oh, damn," she said. "Damn, damn," she sang, girlishly clapping her hands. "I just remembered. I really and truly forgot to do what I went over there to do. I didn't feed Kitty or do any watering." She looked at him. "Isn't that stupid?"
"I don't think so," he said. "Just a minute. I'll get my cigarettes and go back with you."
She waited until he had closed and locked their door, and then she took his arm at the muscle and said, "I guess I should tell you. I found some pictures." He stopped in the middle of the hall.
"What kind of pictures?"
"You can see for yourself," she said, and she watched him.
"No kidding," he grinned. "Where?"
"In a drawer," she said.
"No kidding," he said.
And then she said, "Maybe they won't come back," and was at once astonished at her words.
"It could happen," he said. "Anything could happen."
"Or maybe they'll come back and..." But she did not finish. They held hands for the short walk across the hall, and when he spoke, she could barely hear his voice.
"The key," he said. "Give it to me."
"What?" she said. She gazed at the door.
"The key," he said. "You have the key."
"My God," she said. "I left the key inside." He tried the knob. It was locked. Then she tried the knob. It would not turn. Her lips were parted, and her breathing was hard, expectant. He opened his arms, and she moved into them.
"Don't worry," he said into her ear. "For God's sake, don't worry."
They stayed there. They held each other. They leaned into the door as if against a wind and braced themselves. Note: the following short essay about this story was included in Cutting Edges, Young American Fiction for the 70s, edited by Jack Hicks, pages 528 to 529. Neighbors first hit me as an idea for a story in the fall of 1970, 2 years after returning to the United States from Tel Aviv. While in Tel Aviv, we had for a few days looked after an apartment belonging to some friends. Though none of the hijinks in the story really occurred in the course of our apartment watching, I have to admit that I did do a bit of snooping in the refrigerator and liquor cabinet. I found that experience of entering and leaving someone else's empty apartment 2 or 3 times a day, sitting for a while in other people's chairs, glancing through their books and magazines and looking out their windows, made a rather powerful impression on me. It took 2 years for the impression to surface as a story, but once it did, I simply sat down and wrote it. It seemed a fairly easy story to do at the time, and it came together very quickly after I went to work on it. The real work on the story, and perhaps the art of the story came later. Originally, the manuscript was about twice as long, but I kept paring it on subsequent revisions, and then pared some more until it achieved its present length and dimensions. In addition to the confusion or disorder of the central personality in the story, the main theme at work, I guess, I think that the story has captured an essential sense of mystery or strangeness that is in part due to the treatment of the subject matter, in this case, the story's style. For it is a highly stylized story, if it is anything, and it is this that helps give it its value. With each subsequent trip to the Stone's apartment, Miller is drawn deeper and deeper into an abyss of his own making. The turning point in the story comes, of course, when Arlene insists that this time she will go next door alone, and then, finally, Bill has to go and fetch her. She reveals through words and through appearance. The color in her cheeks is high, and there is white lint clinging to the back of her sweater, that she in turn has been doing pretty much the same kind of rummaging and prowling that he has been engaging in. I think the story is more or less an artistic success. My only fear is that it is too thin, too elliptical and subtle, too inhuman. I hope this is not so, but in truth I do not see it as the kind of story that one loves unreservedly and gives up everything to, a story that is ultimately remembered for its sweep, for the breadth and depth and lifelike sentiment of its characters. No, this is a different kind of story. Not better, maybe, and I surely hope no worse, different in any case. And the internal and external truths and values in the story do not have much to do, I'm afraid, with character or some of the other virtues held dear in short fiction. As to writers and writing that I like, I tend to find much more around that I like than dislike. I think there is all kinds of good stuff getting written and published these days in both the big and little magazines, and in book form. Lots of stuff that's not so good, too, but why worry about that? To my mind, Joyce Carol Oates is the first writer of my generation, perhaps any recent generation, and we are all going to have to learn to live under that shadow, or spell, at least for the foreseeable future. End of note. The idea. We'd finished supper and I'd been at the kitchen table with the light out for the last hour, watching. If he was going to do it tonight, it was time, past time. I hadn't seen him in 3 nights, but tonight the bedroom shade was up over there and the light burning. I had a feeling tonight. Then I saw him. He opened the screen and walked out onto his back porch wearing a t-shirt and something like Bermuda shorts or a swimsuit. He looked around once and hopped off the porch into the shadows and began to move along the side of the house. He was fast. If I hadn't been watching, I wouldn't have seen him. He stopped in front of the lighted window and looked in. "Vern," I called. "Vern, hurry up. He's out there. You'd better hurry." Vern was in the living room reading his paper with the TV going. I heard him throw down the paper. "Don't let him see you," Vern said. "Don't get up too close to the window." Vern always says that. Don't get up too close. Vern's a little embarrassed about watching, I think, but I know he enjoys it. He's said so. "He can't see us with the light out." It's what I always say. This has been going on for 3 months. Since September 3, to be exact. Anyway, that's the first night I saw him over there. I don't know how long it was going on before that. I almost got on the phone to the sheriff that night, until I recognized who it was out there. It took Vern to explain it to me. Even then, it took a while for it to penetrate. But since that night, I've watched. And I can tell you he averages 1 out of every 2 or 3 nights, sometimes more. I've seen him out there when it's been raining, too. In fact, if it is raining, you can bet on seeing him. But tonight, it was clear and windy. There was a moon. We got down on our knees behind the window and Vern cleared his throat. "Look at him," Vern said. Vern was smoking, knocking the ash into his hand when he needed. He held the cigarette away from the window when he puffed. "Vern smokes all the time. There's no stopping him. He even sleeps with an ashtray 3 inches from his head. At night I'm awake and he wakes up and smokes." "By God,"
Vern said. What does she have that other women don't have? I said to Vern after a minute. We were hunkered on the floor with just our heads showing over the windowsill, and were looking at a man who was standing and looking into his own bedroom window.
That's just it, Vern said.
He cleared his throat right next to my ear. He kept watching. I could make out someone behind the curtain now. It must have been her undressing, but I couldn't see any detail. I strained my eyes. Vern was wearing his reading glasses so he could see everything better than I could. Suddenly the curtain was drawn aside and the woman turned her back to the window. What's she doing now? I said, knowing full well.
By God, Vern said.
What's she doing, Vern? I said.
She's taking off her clothes, Vern said. What do you think she's doing?
Then the bedroom light went out, and the man started back along the side of his house. He opened the screen door and slipped inside, and a little later, the rest of the lights went out. Vern coughed again and shook his head. I turned on the light. Vern just sat there on his knees. Then he got to his feet and lighted a cigarette. Someday I'm going to tell that trash what I think of her, I said and looked at Vern. Vern laughed, sort of. I mean it, I said. I'll see her in the market someday, and I'll tell her to her face.
I wouldn't do that. What the hell would you do that for? Vern said.
But I could tell he didn't think I was serious. He frowned and looked at his nails. He rolled his tongue in his mouth and narrowed his eyes like he does when he's concentrating. Then his expression changed and he scratched his chin.
You wouldn't do anything like that, he said.
You'll see, I said.
Shit,
Vern said. I followed him into the living room. We were jumpy. It gets us like that. You wait, I said. Vern ground his cigarette out in the big ashtray. He stood beside his leather chair and looked at the TV a minute.
There's never anything on, he said.
Then he said something else. He said,
maybe he has something there.
Vern lighted another cigarette.
You don't know.
Anybody comes looking in my window, I said, they'll have the cops on them. Except maybe Cary Grant, I said. Vern shrugged.
You don't know, he said.
I had an appetite. I went to the kitchen cupboard and looked, and then I opened the fridge. Vern, you want something to eat? I called. He didn't answer. I could hear water running in the bathroom, but I thought he might want something. We get hungry this time of night. I put bread and lunch meat on the table, and I opened a can of soup. I got out crackers and peanut butter, cold meatloaf, pickles, olives, potato chips. I put everything on the table. Then I thought of the apple pie. Vern came out in his robe and flannel pajamas. His hair was wet and slicked down over the back of his head, and he smelled of toilet water. He looked at the things on the table. He said,
what about a bowl of cornflakes with brown sugar?
Then he sat down and spread his paper out to the side of his plate. We ate our snack, the ashtray filled up with olive pits and his butts. When he'd finished, Vern grinned and said,
what's that good smell?
I went to the oven and took out the two pieces of apple pie topped with melted cheese.
That looks fine, Vern said.
In a little while, he said,
I can't eat anymore. I'm going to bed.
I'm coming too, I said. I'll clear this table. I was scraping plates into the garbage can when I saw the ants. I looked closer. They came from somewhere beneath the pipes under the sink. A steady stream of them, up one side of the can and down the other, coming and going. I found the spray in one of the drawers and sprayed the outside and the inside of the garbage can, and I sprayed as far back under the sink as I could reach. Then I washed my hands and took a last look around the kitchen. Vern was asleep. He was snoring. He'd wake up in a few hours, go to the bathroom, and smoke. The little TV at the foot of the bed was on, but the picture was rolling. I'd wanted to tell Vern about the ants. I took my own time getting ready for bed, fixed the picture, and crawled in. Vern made the noises he does in his sleep. I watched for a while, but it was a talk show, and I don't like talk shows. I started thinking about the ants again. Pretty soon, I imagined them all over the house. I wondered if I should wake Vern and tell him I was having a bad dream. Instead, I got up and went for the can of spray. I looked under the sink again, but there was no ants left. I turned on every light in the house until I had the house blazing. I kept spraying. Finally, I raised the shade in the kitchen and looked out. It was late. The wind blew and I heard branches snap. "That trash," I said. "The idea." I used even worse language, things I can't repeat. They're not your husband. Earl Ober was between jobs as a salesman, but Doreen, his wife, had gone to work nights as a waitress at a 24-hour coffee shop at the edge of town. One night, when he was drinking, Earl decided to stop by the coffee shop and have something to eat. He wanted to see where Doreen worked, and he wanted to see if he could order something on the house. He sat at the counter and studied the menu. "What are you doing here?" Doreen said when she saw him sitting there. She handed over an order to the cook. "What are you going to order, Earl?" she said. "The kids okay?"
"They're fine," Earl said. "I'll have coffee and one of those number two sandwiches."
Doreen wrote it down.
"Any chance of, you know?"
he said to her and winked.
"No," she said. "Don't talk to me now. I'm busy."
Earl drank his coffee and waited for the sandwich. Two men in business suits, their ties undone, their collars open, sat down next to him and asked for coffee. As Doreen walked away with the coffee pot, one of the men said to the other,
"Look at the ass on that. I don't believe it."
The other man laughed.
"I've seen better," he said.
"That's what I mean," the first man said.
"But some jokers like their quim fat."
"Not me,"
the other man said.
"Not me neither," the first man said. "That's what I was saying."
Doreen put the sandwich in front of Earl. Around the sandwich, there were French fries, coleslaw, dill pickle. "Anything else?" she said. "A glass of milk?" He didn't say anything. He shook his head when she kept standing there. "I'll get you more coffee," she said. She came back with the pot and poured coffee for him and for the two men. Then she picked up a dish and turned to get some ice cream. She reached down into the container and with the dipper began to scoop up the ice cream. The white skirt yanked against her hips and crawled up her legs. What showed was girdle, and it was pink, thighs that were rumpled and gray and a little hairy, and veins that spread in a berserk display. The two men sitting beside Earl exchanged looks. One of them raised his eyebrows. The other man grinned and kept looking at Doreen over his cup as she spooned chocolate syrup over the ice cream. When she began shaking the can of whipped cream, Earl got up, leaving his food, and headed for the door. He heard her call his name, but he kept going. He checked on the children and then went to the other bedroom and took off his clothes. He pulled the covers up, closed his eyes, and allowed himself to think. The feeling started in his face and worked down into his stomach and legs. He opened his eyes and rolled his head back and forth on the pillow. Then he turned on his side and fell asleep. In the morning, after she had sent the children off to school, Doreen came into the bedroom and raised the shade. Earl was already awake.
"Look at yourself in the mirror," he said.
"What?" she said. "What are you talking about?"
"Just look at yourself in the mirror," he said.
"What am I supposed to see?" she said. But she looked in the mirror over the dresser and pushed the hair away from her shoulders.
"Well?" he said.
"Well, what?" she said.
"I hate to say anything," Earl said, "but I think you better give a diet some thought. I mean it. I'm serious. I think you could lose a few pounds. Don't get mad."
"What are you saying?" she said.
"Just what I said. I think you could lose a few pounds. A few pounds, anyway, he said.
You never said anything before, she said. She raised her nightgown over her hips and turned to look at her stomach in the mirror.
I never felt it was a problem before, he said.
He tried to pick his words. The nightgown still gathered around her waist. Doreen turned her back to the mirror and looked over her shoulder. She raised one buttock in her hand and let it drop.
Earl closed his eyes. Maybe I'm all wet, he said.
I guess I could afford to lose, but it'd be hard, she said.
You're right. It won't be easy, he said, but I'll help.
Maybe you're right, she said. She dropped her nightgown and looked at him, and then she took her nightgown off. They talked about diets. They talked about the protein diets, the vegetable-only diets, the grapefruit juice diets. But they decided they didn't have the money to buy the steaks the protein diet called for. And Doreen said she didn't care for all that many vegetables. And since she didn't like grapefruit juice that much, she didn't see how she could do that one either.
Okay, forget it, he said.
No, you're right, she said. I'll do something.
What about exercises? He said.
I'm getting all the exercise I need down there, she said.
Just quit eating, Earl said. For a few days, anyway.
All right, she said. I'll try. For a few days, I'll give it a try. You've convinced me.
I'm a closer, Earl said.
He figured out the balance in their checking account, then drove to the discount store and bought a bathroom scale. He looked the clerk over as she rang up the sale. At home, he had Doreen take off all her clothes and get on the scale. He frowned when he saw the veins. He ran his finger the length of one that sprouted up her thigh. What are you doing? She asked.
Nothing, he said.
He looked at the scale and wrote the figure down on a piece of paper.
All right, Earl said. All right.
The next day he was gone for most of the afternoon on an interview. The employer, a heavyset man who limped as he showed Earl around the plumbing fixtures in the warehouse, asked if Earl were free to travel.
You bet I'm free, Earl said.
The man nodded. Earl smiled. He could hear the television before he opened the door to the house. The children did not look up as he walked through the living room. In the kitchen, Doreen, dressed for work, was eating scrambled eggs and bacon.
What are you doing? Earl said.
She continued to chew the food, cheeks puffed, but then she spit everything into a napkin. I couldn't help myself, she said.
Slob, Earl said. Go ahead, eat. Go on.
He went to the bedroom, closed the door, and lay on the covers. He could still hear the television. He put his hands behind his head and stared at the ceiling. She opened the door. I'm going to try again, Doreen said.
Okay, he said.
2 mornings later, she called him into the bathroom. Look, she said. He read the scale. He opened a drawer and took out the paper and read the scale again while she grinned. 3/4 of a pound, she said.
It's something, he said, and patted her hip.
He read the classifieds. He went to the state employment office. Every 3 or 4 days, he drove someplace for an interview, and at night, he counted her tips. He smoothed out the dollar bills on the table and stacked the nickels, dimes, and quarters in piles of $1. Each morning, he put her on the scale. In 2 weeks, she had lost 3.5 pounds. I pick, she said. I starve myself all day, and then I pick at work. It adds up. But a week later, she had lost 5 pounds. The week after that, 9.5 pounds. Her clothes were loose on her. She had to cut into the rent money to buy a new uniform. People are saying things at work, she said.
What kind of things? Earl said.
That I'm too pale, for one thing, she said. That I don't look like myself. They're afraid I'm losing too much weight.
What is wrong with losing? He said. Don't you pay any attention to them. Tell them to mind their own business. They're not your husband.
You don't have to live with them.
I have to work with them, Doreen said.
That's right, Earl said. But they're not your husband.
Each morning he followed her into the bathroom and waited while she stepped onto the scale. He got down on his knees with a pencil and the piece of paper. The paper was covered with dates, days of the week, numbers. He read the number on the scale, consulted the paper, and either nodded his head or pursed his lips. Doreen spent more time in bed now. She went back to bed after the children had left for school, and she napped in the afternoons before going to work. Earl helped her around the house, watched television, and let her sleep. He did all the shopping, and once in a while he went on an interview. One night he put the children to bed, turned off the television, and decided to go for a few drinks. When the bar closed, he drove to the coffee shop. He sat at the counter and waited. When she saw him, she said, "Kids okay?" Earl nodded. He took his time ordering. He kept looking at her as she moved up and down behind the counter. He finally ordered a cheeseburger. She gave the order to the cook and went to wait on someone else. Another waitress came by with a coffee pot and filled Earl's cup.
"Who's your friend?"
he said and nodded at his wife. "Her name's Doreen," the waitress said.
"She looks a lot different than the last time I was in here," he said.
"I wouldn't know," the waitress said. He ate the cheeseburger and drank the coffee. People kept sitting down and getting up at the counter. Doreen waited on most of the people at the counter, though now and then the other waitress came along to take an order. Earl watched his wife and listened carefully. Twice he had to leave his place to go to the bathroom. Each time he wondered if he might have missed hearing something. When he came back the second time, he found his cup gone and someone in his place. He took a stool at the end of the counter next to an older man in a striped shirt. "What do you want?" Doreen said to Earl when she saw him again. "Shouldn't you be home?"
"Give me some coffee," he said.
The man next to Earl was reading a newspaper. He looked up and watched Doreen pour Earl a cup of coffee. He glanced at Doreen as she walked away. Then he went back to his newspaper. Earl sipped his coffee and waited for the man to say something. He watched the man out of the corner of his eye. The man had finished eating and his plate was pushed to the side. The man lit a cigarette, folded the newspaper in front of him, and continued to read. Doreen came by and removed the dirty plate and poured the man more coffee.
"What do you think of that?"
Earl said to the man, nodding at Doreen as she moved down the counter.
"Don't you think that's something special?"
The man looked up. He looked at Doreen and then at Earl, and then went back to his newspaper.
"Well, what do you think?" Earl said. "I'm asking. Does it look good or not? Tell me."
The man rattled the newspaper. When Doreen started down the counter again, Earl nudged the man's shoulder and said,
"I'm telling you something. Listen. Look at the ass on her. Now you watch this now." "Could I have a chocolate sundae?"
Earl called to Doreen. She stopped in front of him and let out her breath. Then she turned and picked up a dish and the ice cream dipper. She leaned over the freezer, reached down, and began to press the dipper into the ice cream. Earl looked at the man and winked as Doreen's skirt traveled up her thighs. But the man's eyes caught the eyes of the other waitress. And then the man put the newspaper under his arm and reached into his pocket. The other waitress came straight to Doreen.
"Who is this character?" she said.
"Who?" Doreen said and looked around with the ice cream dish in her hand.
"Him," the other waitress said and nodded at Earl. "Who is this joker anyway?"
Earl put on his best smile. He held it. He held it until he felt his face pulling out of shape. But the other waitress just studied him, and Doreen began to shake her head slowly. The man had put some change beside his cup and stood up, but he too waited to hear the answer. They all stared at Earl. "He's a salesman. He's my husband," Doreen said at last, shrugging. Then she put the unfinished chocolate sundae in front of him and went to total up his check. Are you a doctor? In slippers, pajamas, and robe,
He hurried out of the study when the telephone began to ring. Since it was past 10, the call would be his wife. She phoned, late like this, after a few drinks, each night when she was out of town. She was a buyer, and all this week she had been away on business.
"Hello, dear," he said. "Hello," he said again.
"Who is this?" a woman asked.
"Well, who is this?" he said. "What number do you want?"
"Just a minute," the woman said. "It's 273-8063.
"That's my number," he said. "How did you get it?"
"I don't know. It was written down on a piece of paper when I got in from work," the woman said.
"Who wrote it down?"
"I don't know," the woman said. "The sitter, I guess. It must be her."
"Well, I don't know how she got it," he said, "but it's my telephone number and it's unlisted. I'd appreciate it if you'd just toss it away. Hello? Did you hear me?"
"Yes, I heard," the woman said.
"Is there anything else?" he said. "It's late and I'm busy."
He hadn't meant to be curt, but one couldn't take chances. He sat down on the chair by the telephone and said,
"I hadn't meant to be curt. I only meant that it's late and I'm concerned how you happen to have my number."
He pulled off his slipper and began massaging his foot, waiting.
"I don't know either," she said. "I told you I just found the number written down, no note or anything. I'll ask Annette, that's the sitter, when I see her tomorrow. I didn't mean to disturb you. I only just now found the note. I've been in the kitchen ever since I came in from work."
"It's all right," he said. "Forget it. Just throw it away or something and forget it. There's no problem, so don't worry."
He moved the receiver from one ear to the other.
"You sound like a nice man," the woman said.
"Do I? Well, that's nice of you to say."
He knew he should hang up now, but it was good to hear a voice, even his own, in the quiet room.
"Oh, yes," she said. "I can tell."
He let go his foot.
"What's your name, if you don't mind my asking?" she said.
"My name is Arnold," he said.
"And what's your first name?" she said.
"Arnold is my first name," he said.
"Oh, forgive me," she said. "Arnold is your first name. And your second name, Arnold? What's your second name?"
"I really must hang up," he said.
"Arnold, for goodness sake, I'm Clara Holt. Now, your name is Mr. Arnold what?"
"Arnold Bright," he said, and then quickly added, "Clara Holt, that's nice. But I really think I should hang up now, Miss Holt. I'm expecting a call."
"I'm sorry, Arnold. I didn't mean to take up your time," she said.
"That's all right," he said. "It's been nice talking with you."
"You're kind to say that, Arnold."
"Will you hold the phone a minute?" he said. "I have to check on something."
He went into the study for a cigar, took a minute lighting it up with the desk lighter, then removed his glasses and looked at himself in the mirror over the fireplace. When he returned to the telephone, he was half afraid she might be off the line.
"Hello?"
"Hello, Arnold," she said.
"I thought you might have hung up."
"Oh, no," she said.
"About your having my number," he said. "Nothing to worry about, I don't suppose. Just throw it away, I suppose."
"I will, Arnold," she said.
"Well, I must say goodbye, then."
"Yes, of course," she said. "I'll say goodnight now."
He heard her draw a breath.
"I know I'm imposing, Arnold, but do you think we could meet somewhere we could talk? Just for a few minutes?"
"I'm afraid that's impossible," he said.
"Just for a minute, Arnold. My finding your number and everything. I feel strongly about this, Arnold."
"I'm an old man," he said.
"Oh, you're not," she said.
"Really, I'm old," he said.
"Could we meet somewhere, Arnold? You see, I haven't told you everything. There's something else," the woman said.
"What do you mean?" he said. "What is this exactly? Hello?"
She had hung up. When he was preparing for bed, his wife called, somewhat intoxicated, he could tell, and they chatted for a while, but he said nothing about the other call. Later, as he was turning the covers down, the telephone rang again. He picked up the receiver.
Hello, Arnold Bright speaking.
Arnold, I'm sorry we got cut off. As I was saying, I think it's important we meet. The next afternoon, as he put the key into the lock, he could hear the telephone ringing. He dropped his briefcase and, still in hat, coat, and gloves, hurried over to the table and picked up the receiver. Arnold, I'm sorry to bother you again, the woman said, but you must come to my house tonight around 9 or 9:30. Can you do that for me, Arnold? His heart moved when he heard her use his name.
I couldn't do that, he said.
Please, Arnold, she said. It's important or I wouldn't be asking. I can't leave the house tonight because Cheryl is sick with a cold and now I'm afraid for the boy.
And your husband? He waited.
I'm not married, she said. You will come, won't you?
I can't promise, he said.
I implore you to come, she said, and then quickly gave him the address and hung up.
I implore you to come, he repeated,
still holding the receiver. He slowly took off his gloves and then his coat. He felt he had to be careful. He went to wash up. When he looked in the bathroom mirror, he discovered the hat. It was then that he made the decision to see her, and he took off his hat and glasses and soaped his face. He checked his nails.
You're sure this is the right street?
He asked the driver.
This is the street and there's the building, the driver said.
Keep going,
he said.
Let me out at the end of the block.
He paid the driver. Lights from the upper windows illuminated the balconies. He could see planters on the balustrades, and here and there a piece of lawn furniture. At one balcony, a large man in a sweatshirt leaned over the railing and watched him walk toward the door. He pushed the button under C. Holt. The buzzer sounded, and he stepped back to the door and entered. He climbed the stairs slowly, stopping to rest briefly at each landing. He remembered the hotel in Luxembourg, the 5 flights he and his wife had climbed so many years ago. He felt a sudden pain in his side, imagined his heart, imagined his legs folding under him, imagined a loud fall to the bottom of the stairs. He took out his handkerchief and wiped his forehead. Then he removed his glasses and wiped the lenses, waiting for his heart to quiet. He looked down the hall. The apartment house was very quiet. He stopped at her door, removed his hat, and knocked lightly. The door opened a crack to reveal a plump little girl in pajamas.
Are you Arnold Bright? She said.
Yes, I am, he said. Is your mother home?
She said for you to come in. She said to tell you she went to the drugstore for some cough syrup and aspirin.
He shut the door behind him.
What is your name? Your mother told me, but I forgot.
When the girl said nothing, he tried again.
What is your name? Isn't your name Shirley?
Cheryl, she said. C-H-E-R-Y-L.
Yes, now I remember. Well, I was close, you must admit.
She sat on a hassock across the room and looked at him.
So you're sick, are you?
He said. She shook her head.
Not sick?
No, she said.
He looked around. The room was lighted by a gold floor lamp that had a large ashtray and a magazine rack affixed to the pole. A television set stood against the far wall, the picture on, the volume low. A narrow hallway led to the back of the apartment. The furnace was turned up, the air close with a medicinal smell. Hairpins and rollers lay on the coffee table. A pink bathrobe lay on the couch. He looked at the child again, then raised his eyes toward the kitchen and the glass doors that gave off the kitchen onto the balcony. The doors stood slightly ajar, and a little chill went through him as he recalled the large man in the sweatshirt.
Mama went out for a minute,
the child said as if suddenly waking up. He leaned forward on his toes, hat in hand, and stared at her.
I think I'd better go, he said.
A key turned in the lock, the door swung open, and a small, pale, freckled woman entered carrying a paper sack.
Arnold, I'm glad to see you.
She glanced at him quickly, uneasily, and shook her head strangely from side to side as she walked to the kitchen with the sack. He heard a cupboard door shut. The child sat on the hassock and watched him. He leaned his weight first on one leg and then the other, then placed the hat on his head and removed it in the same motion as the woman reappeared.
Are you a doctor? She asked.
No, he said, startled. No, I am not.
Cheryl is sick, you see. I've been out buying things. Why didn't you take the man's coat? She said, turning to the child. Please forgive her. We're not used to company.
I can't stay, he said. I really shouldn't have come.
Please sit down, she said. We can't talk like this. Let me give her some medicine first, then we can talk.
I really must go, he said. From the tone of your voice, I thought there was something urgent, but I really must go.
He looked down at his hands and was aware he had been gesturing feebly.
I'll put on tea water, he heard her say, as if she hadn't been listening. Then I'll give Cheryl her medicine and then we can talk.
She took the child by the shoulders and steered her into the kitchen. He saw the woman pick up a spoon, open a bottle of something after scanning the label, and pour out two doses.
Now you say goodnight to Mr. Bright, sweetness, and go to your room.
He nodded to the child and then followed the woman to the kitchen. He did not take the chair she indicated, but instead one that let him face the balcony, the hallway, and the small living room.
Do you mind if I smoke a cigar? He asked.
I don't mind, she said. I don't think it will bother me, Arnold. Please do.
He decided against it. He put his hands on his knees and gave his face a serious expression.
This is still very much of a mystery to me, he said. It's quite out of the ordinary, I assure you.
I understand, Arnold, she said. You'd probably like to hear the story of how I got your number.
I would indeed, he said.
They sat across from each other, waiting for the water to boil. He could hear the television. He looked around the kitchen and then out toward the balcony again. The water began to bubble.
You were going to tell me about the number, he said.
What, Arnold? I'm sorry, she said.
He cleared his throat.
Tell me how you acquired my number, he said.
I checked with Annette, the sitter. But of course you know that. Anyway, she told me the phone rang while she was here, and it was for somebody wanting me. They left a number to call, and it was your number she took down. That's all I know.
She moved a cup around in front of her.
I'm sorry I can't tell you any more.
Your water is boiling, he said.
She put out spoons, milk, sugar, and poured the steaming water over the tea bags. He added sugar and stirred his tea.
You said it was urgent that I come.
Oh, that, Arnold, she said, turning away. I don't know what made me say that. I can't imagine what I was thinking.
Then there's nothing, he said.
No. I mean, yes, she shook her head. What you said, I mean, nothing.
I see, he said.
He went on stirring his tea.
It's unusual, he said after a time, almost to himself. Quite unusual.
He smiled weakly, then moved the cup to one side and touched his lips with the napkin.
You aren't leaving, she said.
I must, he said. I'm expecting a call at home.
Not yet, Arnold.
She scraped her chair back and stood up. Her eyes were a pale green, set deep in her pale face and surrounded by what he had at first thought was dark makeup. Appalled at himself, knowing he would despise himself for it,
He stood and put his arms clumsily around her waist. She let herself be kissed, fluttering and closing her eyelids briefly.
"It's late,"
he said, letting go, turning away unsteadily.
"You've been very gracious, but I must be leaving, Mrs. Holt. Thank you for the tea."
"You will come again, won't you, Arnold?" she said.
He shook his head. She followed him to the door, where he held out his hand. He could hear the television. He was sure the volume had been turned up. He remembered the other child then, the boy. Where was he? She took his hand, raised it quickly to her lips.
"You mustn't forget me, Arnold."
"I won't," he said. "Clara. Clara Holt,"
he said.
"We had a good talk," she said.
She picked at something, a hair, a thread, on his suit collar.
"I'm very glad you came, and I feel certain you'll come again."
He looked at her carefully, but she was staring past him now as if she were trying to remember something.
"Now, good night, Arnold," she said,
and with that she shut the door, almost catching his overcoat.
"Strange,"
he said as he started down the stairs. He took a long breath when he reached the sidewalk and paused a moment to look back at the building, but he was unable to determine which balcony was hers. The large man in the sweatshirt moved slightly against the railing and continued looking down at him. He began walking, hands deep in his coat pockets. When he reached home, the telephone was ringing. He stood very quietly in the middle of the room, holding the key between his fingers until the ringing stopped. Then, tenderly, he put a hand against his chest and felt, through the layers of clothes, his beating heart. After a time, he made his way into the bedroom. Almost immediately, the telephone came alive again, and this time he answered it.
"Arnold. Arnold Bright speaking," he said.
"Arnold. My, aren't we formal tonight?"
his wife said, her voice strong, teasing.
"I've been calling since 9. Out living it up, Arnold."
He remained silent and considered her voice.
"Are you there, Arnold?"
she said.
"You don't sound like yourself."
The father. The baby lay in a basket beside the bed, dressed in a white bonnet and sleeper. The basket had been newly painted and tied with ice blue ribbons and padded with blue quilts. The three little sisters and the mother, who had just gotten out of bed and was still not herself, and the grandmother all stood around the baby, watching it stare and sometimes raise its fist to its mouth. He did not smile or laugh, but now and then he blinked his eyes and flicked his tongue back and forth through his lips when one of the girls rubbed his chin. The father was in the kitchen and could hear them playing with the baby.
"Who do you love, baby?"
Phyllis said and tickled his chin.
"He loves us all,"
Phyllis said.
"But he really loves Daddy because Daddy's a boy too."
The grandmother sat down on the edge of the bed and said, "Look at its little arm, so fat, and those little fingers, just like its mother."
"Isn't he sweet?" the mother said. "So healthy, my little baby."
And bending over, she kissed the baby on its forehead and touched the cover over its arm.
"We love him too."
"But who does he look like? Who does he look like?"
Alice cried, and they all moved up closer around the basket to see who the baby looked like.
"He has pretty eyes," Carol said.
"All babies have pretty eyes," Phyllis said.
"He has his grandfather's lips," the grandmother said. "Look at those lips."
"I don't know," the mother said. "I wouldn't say."
"The nose, the nose,"
Alice cried.
"What about his nose?" the mother asked.
"It looks like somebody's nose," the girl answered.
"No, I don't know," the mother said. "I don't think so." "Those lips," the grandmother murmured. "Those little fingers,"
she said, uncovering the baby's hand and spreading out its fingers.
Who does the baby look like? He doesn't look like anybody, Phyllis said, and they moved even closer. I know, Carol said. He looks like Daddy.
Then they looked closer at the baby.
But who does Daddy look like? Phyllis asked. Who does Daddy look like? Alice repeated, and they all at once looked through to the kitchen where the father was sitting at the table with his back to them. Why, nobody, Phyllis said, and began to cry a little.
Hush, the grandmother said, and looked away and then back at the baby.
Daddy doesn't look like anybody, Alice said.
But he has to look like somebody, Phyllis said, wiping her eyes with one of the ribbons. And all of them except the grandmother looked at the father sitting at the table. He had turned around in his chair, and his face was white and without expression. Nobody said anything. I could hear them out in the kitchen. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but they were arguing. Then it got quiet and she started to cry. I elbowed George. I thought he would wake up and say something to them so they would feel guilty and stop. But George is such an asshole. He started kicking and hollering. Stop gouging me, you bastard, he said. I'm going to tell. You dumb chicken shit, I said. Can't you wise up for once? They're fighting and Mom's crying. Listen. He listened with his head off the pillow. I don't care, he said and turned over toward the wall and went back to sleep. George is a royal asshole. Later I heard Dad leave to catch his bus. He slammed the front door. She had told me before he wanted to tear up the family. I didn't want to listen. After a while, she came to call us for school. Her voice sounded funny. I don't know.